Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Well, welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and of course it's Wednesday, which is always a wicked day around here, and that's because we have the dreaded Michael the Holly.
How you doing, Al?
See, it's the Holly, because we're matching Jack the Ripper.
That is correct, and he's in 2 feet of snow right now in Buffalo. So
yeah. You see, you have the same last name as him. So when are you going to come out and tell us, instead of writing about, your dog?
Well, my middle name is The, so, right. You know, I'm a reincarnated serial killer.
No, you're just old. You're that old. You look it.
Yes, and you're just a month younger than me.
Well, yeah, but that's a very big month. A lot happens in a month. It's not that short. Well, speaking of Wicket and darkness, we've got a book that we're featuring today called A Seance for Wicket King Death. With us is the author of that book, Coy Hall. So thanks for being here, Coy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nice to speak with you, Coy.
Thank you.
Well, Coy, so this is interesting. So you got this book out, and tell us, okay, first of all, just give us a little premise on the book, and then we'll get into some more detail.
Yeah, this is a looking at it as a noir thriller type of story. It's set in 1956. A lot of the stuff that I write is set in the past. A lot of my books are set in the distant past, in the 17th century, and even back into the Middle Ages. So this is the most modern story I've told in 1956. It's a story, though, that is centered on a con artist, a person who is a charlatan conducting seances, and he preys upon grieving people. And he was in trouble for that in the 1940s. He was in trouble, and he got in a case of fraud, and he went to prison. And when the novel begins, he is out of prison. And he wants nothing to do with that old world, but of course an old colleague comes and pulls him back into this world of parlor tricks and seances, and the plot unfolds from there.
Is it so 1956, what do you do to get your head into that? Like myself, when I'm writing stuff right now, I'm covering something in the 60s and the 80s. Quite often, I go back to old shows. I'm watching old movies, old TV shows. I stay away from modern things. I'm just kind of, I get totally engulfed in these sort of things. What do you do to get your mood there, or do you have to do anything?
Well, I like to read novels from that period. People like David Goodis, noir novels in that vein in the 1950s. But I also like to listen to get a feel of dialogue. I like to listen to radio programs from the 50s. I'm a big fan of the old-time radio. And so shows like Dragnet and things that, you know, with Jack Webb that began on radio, you can really get a feel for dialogue from those in that time, the way people spoke. X-1 is another favorite science fiction anthology from the radio show from the 50s. But a little bit of everything like that, reading books and watching movies, listening to radio shows, all of that gets me into that headspace.
Yeah, I listen to those every night. I'm, you know, Richard Diamond or
yes,
whatever. I go through all the old ones and I've been doing that for years. It's just a great setting. It's kind of an interesting way of writing as well. It's different than modern writing. Let's talk about your main character here, or one of the, Royce Pembroke. So who is Royce Pembroke and what kind of relationship do you find yourself having with Royce?
Royce is one of my favorite characters I've ever created. He is, I found him to be just a very layered person. And as I told this is a short novel at 200 pages, but I felt like I really brought out a lot of him, you know, and kind of just broad brush strokes of his past. But as a character, he's someone who was born into wealth, and he is someone who experienced having wealth and losing that wealth. He lost it. So he comes from this prestigious family in the area of Cincinnati, Ohio. And his grandfather had made a fortune. And so he has this privileged life as a child. And he knows that and then loses that. It does kind of create this sophistication, though, for Royce, where he can speak French, for example. He can easily communicate with the, you know, the upper echelon when he's trying to scam people. He's a very knowledgeable, well educated person, and yet there's this contrast with him where he really, you know, by the 1950s, he's fallen on hard times, and he lives, you know, he's essentially in the gutter at that point and struggling mightily. So he's got this background to him,
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
It really shapes how he sees the world. He is not someone who you necessarily look up to. I don't think I even agree with all of the things that Royce does and says and thinks, but I find him, you know, this fascinating person. And above all, he's, you know, blessed with this charisma in which he can make people think what he wants them to think, and that serves him well in his con game.
And so how do you experience him? Do you hear your characters, or do you see them like a movie, or maybe describe that?
Yeah, I hear Royce. The novel's told in first person, so it's Royce talking, and it's Royce's thoughts. And I channeled that. You know, I tried to channel that when I was writing it and think like Royce would think and speak like Royce would speak. Having this background, this sophisticated background, and this, you know, education informs how he speaks. And yet, he knows how to deal with different types of people too. So, I certainly hear Royce, when I'm writing that character.
You just don't drive when you're hearing these voices, do you?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. It works for me. So.
Hey, people, there you go.
People leave me alone. You know, I just always
stay off the road.
Question on him. You know, your protagonist, it sounds like he's not like perfectly a great person, good person deep down, or is he? Is he? And I mean, it sounds like it's quite a rich character that you have here. That is that what you're trying to do? Is not have just like this perfect person?
Yeah, I don't think anybody would read this book and conclude that Royce is a good person. He is always looking out for himself. I think what makes him interesting is that regardless, he's likable. You don't like what he's doing, but you want to like Royce. And I think of people like that in real life where you want them to like you. And you want to like them, you know, regardless of their behavior sometimes. And it's this, I feel like it's this charisma that carries that off.
Right. And something like that, I guess you've kind of really got to get into the head and explain why they do the things they do. If there must be a reasoning to him trying to scam people, for instance, other than just make money. There's something else going on, I would guess.
Yeah. Royce is an entitled person. I think that comes from his background of being born into wealth and never earning wealth. And he feels he deserves it, and he will, you know, he will try to get to that end by any possible route, and people are in his way. I don't think Royce deeply loves anyone, right? He has shallow feelings towards other people, but he certainly loves himself. And he is always looking out for himself and his own personal gain. One thing that I really liked playing with this character was how Royce thinks a certain way and speaks in another way. Right, he thinks in a certain way, speaks in another way, and I was influenced by that, by the novel In a Lonely Place, wherein the character thinks a certain way and is extremely violent internally, but is very likable and charismatic, outside.
With that, you know, do you have a subtext, a meaning underneath the story, besides what's happening in the main part, besides the entertainment, let's say? Is there some sort of a subtext?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of social commentary about the 1950s. You know, my main job is being a historian, and I'm very interested in 1950s and all the problems of society in that time. And there's a lot of commentary. Royce is a homosexual man in the 1950s, and he's openly gay in the 1950s, which is part of the novel. And that's, you know, part of how he deals with that and what he faces. And I think kind of getting into those layers, regardless of what, you know, you feel about Royce as a character, getting into those layers, of society in the 1950s is certainly part of the book, and was part of my intention with it.
So a question on there must be a lot. You said you were kind of a historian. So do you do like direct research on that specific book you have? Let's say, you know, you said that you have go back far in history. So do you really do some research first before you go into that?
Yeah.
Or while you're doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. I generally read, you know, nonfiction books about the era which I'm writing. History is about that era that I'm writing, always. And I try to do that before I write the book and while I'm writing the book, because you never know where you'll hit inspiration along the way.
I just remember when I was doing one of my fiction novels that my editor said that with a tidbit of a historical fiction, I mean, even though it's fiction, you better have your facts right, because people that love that era will hate it if you get the facts wrong.
Right, yeah. So. And I feel that's one of the – so with my books, I do try to keep separate the historian side and the author of fiction side. I try to keep those things separate because I don't want things in the book that are anachronistic. And especially in language, I always try to keep a focus on language and word usage in the time. I don't try to go for a lot of, you know, gimmicky jargon from the time. I don't lay that on, but I do try to keep it true to the time. But I think the most important thing is for it to seem real. Fiction needs to seem real, because real history doesn't always feel real to people who are maybe not heavily invested in the 1950s. There are things that, you know, might be real, but might not seem real. So my goal always is to make the book seem real rather than necessarily be real.
Right. And I guess a good advantage to historical fiction is you can create a lot of dialogue with your characters and thought to kind of help tell the story of that time. So I think that's important. Do you come up with the character first? Did you come up with Royce first and then put him in the situation? Or did you have the story sort of kind of in your mind and you created the character to work in it?
I actually he came out of a short story. I wrote a short story called Tibet Has a Book of the Dead 2. T-O-O, and it was about a con man, like on a carnival circuit in the 1940s. And it was he was a nameless character in that. But even being a short story and being a nameless character, he had a certain texture to him that I liked. And so I took that character and that became Royce. And I think of that story as part of his background, like he was on the carnival circuit in the 1940s and reading fortunes and things like that. And that's how it began. So it began with a short story, but Royce existed before the novel existed.
And so what happens to your character, someone like Royce, when the book is over and you're finished and it's published? and you're moving on. Do your characters disappear or do they stay with you?
Well, they stay with me. And I think that if I write something terminal in a book with a character, I'm always willing to maybe go back and do prequel type of short stories. If I have a really good character that, you know, I really like, I'm willing to go back before that. So it's never the end when I finish. And if it isn't terminal at the end, then I might write another novel. And I did write another Royce Pembroke novel, and it'll be out this November.
Oh, wow. So, well, you can always make it a dream if he gets killed, right?
Right.
Sorry. Tacky. Yeah. Well, listen, so when you do that, when you started this and you took it from the short story and you sort of created this book, did you know then that you were going to add another book to the series? Do you kind of know ahead of time? Do you outline, or is it just completely at will?
No, I didn't know how this book would end. Therefore, I didn't have any idea of writing another book with this character. When I first started it, when I first began writing it, it was right at the, I wrote it back in 2020, right when lockdown and COVID had began. And I thought, I'm going to write a crime novel. And I had that character and stuff. So I did that. And it was going to be a standalone novel at that point. But the way it ended, the way the novel ends, I feel like there's more for this character to do and say. So there's one more novel out of it. That's probably going to be the end of the Royce Pembroke novels. I don't like to repeat myself too often. So
will that be the end of your crime novels too, or
will
you continue that?
No, I plan to write more. I like to write a lot of genres, but crime's one I love to read, and so I'll definitely return.
So when you do something like this and you're writing the book, do you ever think about the reader?
I do, and I think of the readers of different genres too, as I think that's an important thing. When you do write in different genres, expectations of readers and maybe tolerance of readers when you're thinking of violence and things like that. And that is something that goes into my mind always when I'm planning out the book, but also when I'm editing the book and kind of going over and doing subsequent drafts. So I think of, you know, are you in this genre reader's mindset? You know, that's definitely a thought.
So you have to be conscious of the amount of violence or how you write violence, let's say, or murder or bad things.
Yeah.
In the book itself, right?
Yeah. So violence occurs, but it's always, and I guess one of my thinkings with crime books is, you know, you're going to show someone being hit, but you're not going to discuss the impact of that hit. Someone was just hit, right? In other genres, you might describe that impact a little more. So it kind of, I guess you pull the camera away. I had that thought with writing this book, and I did tone it down. You know, I'd written kind of more visceral fighting. There's one particular scene in the book where someone has a sock that's full of broken glass, right? A sock full of broken glass, and he's beating someone with a sock of broken glass. And obviously you could describe that as much as you wanted, the impact of that. And so I did, you know, think of that when I was editing it and kind of edited that part, the impact part down.
Does that include language too?
That's something I consider. The language isn't particularly bad in the book, so that wasn't something that had to be edited down. But yeah, that's something I would consider. If I was writing like a cozy mystery especially, that'd be something I would, you know, be conscious of.
But don't you find you have to be a little bit conscious of, let's say, the behaviors and the way people treat people in the 50s as compared to us now? Because a lot of behaviors back then, like, you know, you bring up the homosexual aspect. To be gay back in the 50s, it was illegal. That way you could be arrested. So it's a different sort of time. So people might not be as friendly to your character in this situation as they would be, let's say, today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So do you have to sort of kind of work around it, or do you have people that are, you know, how they were? Like, do you think about that?
Yeah, I do think about that. I have people in the book who are cruel to him for that. The one thing I'm conscious of, you can portray someone being cruel for differences in the 1950s, but not necessarily using the exact language that they would have used in the 50s. You can go light on that and still get your point across. And that's something I was, you know, conscious of.
Right. There's a way to do it.
Right. You know, you don't want to use slurs and things like that. So it was kind of a balancing act to get that cruelty across and yet not, you know, go as far maybe as someone would in the 1950s.
So now the setting, do you detail the setting? Do you write a setting in this sort of situation like a character?
I do. And the book goes between Cincinnati, Ohio, and a small town called Huntington. And these are both dirty Ohio River towns, you know, in the 1950s. And that is very much a distinct character and atmosphere and texture in the book.
And when you get into the seances and you're dealing with a lot of the, I don't know what you call the paranormal world, sort of in a sense, but of course in a fraudulent way and stuff like that. How do you get into writing about the seances and stuff? Do you have kind of a background where you're into the paranormal and that, or is there something that led you into that subject? Or
very, very interested as a historian in spiritualism in the 19th century, but also in the 1920s. And that is the texture that's what I went after with this, you know, the idea of like the Harry Houdini era, you know, where in Houdini's time, the Scientific American they put up this bounty, this reward of whoever could pass their panel of judges and prove that the paranormal exists, would get this cash reward. And of course, no one ever claimed it. They tried. They were always proved to be fraudulent. And I'm very, very interested in that. And so I had read a lot on that. And a lot of the details, the character in the book who's his group is leading the seances, he's an older man, and he learned his spiritualism in the 1920s. And so it has that distinct Houdini era feel.
So Royce is a person that's probably skeptical of that, but still takes advantage of that, and then you could work that angle, or will you have?
Right, and Royce doesn't believe in any of this. He knows about it. He's a well-read man, and he has read like Sir Oliver Lodge, and he's read Arthur Conan Doyle and these like the spiritual pontiffs, you know, of that time and what they were writing. And so he knows what to say. He knows the gospels of that faith, and he can preach it. That doesn't mean he believes it, but he uses that.
So your character, Anna Vogel. So tell us about her.
Anna is cut from the same cloth as Royce, as far as having this background as a scam artist. And she passes herself off as a medium, right? Person who talks to the spirit world. One contrast with Royce is that she comes from a background of poverty, and she has, you know, she kind of has this awe of Royce's background and this jealousy about Royce's background. And she is where he can talk to, you know, the people he's scamming, upper class people, with ease. For Anna, she always feels like she's kind of tattooed with her poverty, you know, and always this kind of self-conscious feeling about it. And so that's a contrast with her.
How do you get into writing a female character then?
Well, you know, one thing I always try to do, I know my limitations. And when I will write it without input first. I'll write a woman without input first, but I always make certain to have my wife read it, and I have two sisters, so I have my siblings read it, and I tell them to be as critical as possible. And they will say, a woman wouldn't think like this, or a woman wouldn't do this in this situation, or a woman would feel this way in this situation. And they give me detailed feedback, and I will do another draft just focusing on female characters in the book based on that feedback. And I do feel that it fleshes them out, and it prevents some of the pitfalls that can come from not consulting women when writing women.
Right. How much yourself do you think you put into each character?
A lot. I can't help that. My interests go into the characters, my background, what I know about things, all those things go into the characters. The books on their shelves are usually like the books on my shelves when I'm describing, you know, them. So
that makes it enjoyable then.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also like a time capsule. I think people read these books, it's kind of, it arrests this point in time, and it reflects my interests up to that time. And it's an interesting autobiographical piece in that way.
So what do you hope when someone picks up the book, takes it home and reads it, what do you hope they take away from it?
Well, you know, I'm very simple about that. I hope they have a good time with it and enjoy it. It's written as the plot moves fast in it, and I hope it's kind of grips them and carries them to the end, and they enjoy reading it. I don't really expect anything else out of anybody other than that. There is subtext in the book, and there's richness to the characters and to the setting and to the talk of spiritualism and these things. But I just want people to enjoy the book, enjoy the plot.
So now, when did you get into writing? When did this start for you, where you decided you were going to write a book?
Well, back when I was a teenager, I wanted to write screenplays. Well, I actually wanted to write, talking earlier about radio programs, I began trying to write like radio programs, you know, these are old time radio style. And I wrote some scripts there. And then I thought, I'm going to write film scripts. But then I learned that I didn't actually enjoy collaborating with other people, which is a big limitation with those things. And so I thought, you don't have to collaborate with anyone. Well, I didn't know this at the time, right? But I thought, you don't have to collaborate with anyone if you just write a novel. There's no budget restrictions. There's nothing there. You get just your imagination is the only limitation, and you don't have to deal with other human beings. And so that got me into that. And I wrote my first novel when I was 18, and been writing ever since. I read, I like Ray Bradbury as an author, and he had a huge collection, like 100 stories by Ray Bradbury. And he had this great introduction. And in it, he said, the only education you need as a writer is to write 1 million words. And I took that to heart. So I said, oh, well, I'm going to write 1 million words out of novels and short stories. And I did that, and I haven't looked back.
Well, there you go. Well, but it's an interesting business, and it keeps changing because there's a business side to it. So sometimes it's got to be frustrating. And now, I guess, you know, with the Amazon and the ontake of a lot of self-publishing and all that stuff, it makes it a pretty saturated market. So it's a lot harder to work now, I would imagine.
Yeah, writing is enjoyable, but actually trying to sell a book is not very enjoyable, and it can be frustrating. And it is a saturated field, and it's hard to have your voice rise above other people. And it's really a constant battle not to sink, I think, when you put a book out and into the world, and you're always conscious of that. That's not enjoyable.
Yeah, no, it's hard. It's hard. Now, you've also, you write a lot of horror or darker as well, right?
And
where do you think that comes from?
Well, it's the same place I think that the crime writing comes from, or when I write science fiction, I like dark stories, you know, like kind of macabre adventure. At their heart, they're kind of like macabre adventures. And those genres, for the sake of marketing, you know, I have to say this is a horror novel, or this is a crime novel, or this is a science fiction novel. But, you know, when I am enjoying stories and trying to conceive stories, those lines blur. And so I'm always kind of dancing back and forth between genres.
But never nonfiction.
Yeah, I mean, I do write some nonfiction, but I do plan to write nonfiction histories as well. It's on my in my future. I want to try to do a little bit of everything. If I like to read it, I want to write it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, and you also, okay, so let's say it looks like you do some YouTube work as well. Do you do videos as well for YouTube?
No, not generally. I had, so at the, where I teach, the library at the college had wanted to ask me to do something for Halloween. And so I thought, I want to channel my inner Vincent Price. And I'm going to sit down and I'm going to, you know, tell a scary story in my best impersonation of Vincent Price. And so I did three of those, the in which I put on my bow tie with bats on it and pumpkins and sat down and told stories. I've done three of those so far. So probably more of those to come in the future. But that's just with the school library, and I do those, and I put them on YouTube when it's all finished.
So what's coming next for you then? So this book is out now. It came out, I guess, last year, I think November.
Right.
What do you got coming up next?
Well, I have three projects this year that are releasing. In April, the first fiction anthology that I edited is releasing, and it's called Death's Other Kingdom. Horror tales of the First World War, of World War One, and that will be releasing in April. And proud of that because it's kind of branching off and trying something new with editing and anthology, and that was a fun experience. In June of this year, I have a science fiction novel releasing called Colossus with a Poison Tongue, and then in November I have another Royce Pembroke novel, crime novel, releasing called The Switchblade Svengali, and it's set in 1968. This one's in 56. The next one's 12 years later.
So he's old now.
Yeah. Yes, older. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's all good. Now, are you doing social media? Do you do website? Where do people find you? Do you like interacting with the readers?
I do. I love it. I have a basic website, coyhall.com, but most of the time I'm on Twitter. I'm not going to call it by the other name, but Twitter at Coy Hall Books, and Instagram at Coy Hall Books. Those are my main two social media places, but I'm also on Facebook and Blue Sky and places like that as well.
Well, that's interesting. So where do you think you get influences from besides writers, other writers or movies and stuff? Is there things in your day-to-day life that you think influence some of your writing?
Yeah, teaching history more than anything else gives me ideas that, you know, those are the kernels of stories a lot of the times that I think of when I'm telling these stories to classes. And I think that would make a good story. That would make a good novel. Nobody's written anything like that. I think if you mine history, you're never going to have a shortage of ideas. And you write, you know, dark stories, darker fiction, you're not going to have any, you know, limitations about the amount of cruelty in the past or the things that people do to one another or the just horrific events, you know, as well that occur. And that's always something I look at and say, I want to tell a story about that, or I want to tell a story set in that time.
Right. Having an intermittent. And, you know, and do you really see it ending? I mean, history keeps writing each day, right? So we keep still doing horrible things to each other.
Consistent, yes.
People
are people. If they're in the 5th century or they're in the 21st century, people treat people the same way. People do not change in that regard.
Yeah, it's kind of endless. The names change, but it's kind of the same.
Yes. I think it's like cosmetic differences, you know, but it's just surface level differences. But the motivations stay the same.
Yeah, I see a lot of that cycling in today and what goes on in today's world. And I see so many of it's just the repeat. So much of the same fight, but with different names and
yes,
kind of a different way of doing it, you know.
Yes, and that's something that, it's easy to become a pessimist, I think, if you study history, because it does seem that no matter what, people do the same exact thing. They do the same exact things over and over and over again. It's built in.
Yeah, it never ends. Do you ever kill anybody off that you know in your bitten-ass characters in your books?
I won't get into specifics about that for reasons, but yes.
Well, we wanted some names and phone numbers.
After, just stay, just hang around after. Yeah. We'll get that ironed out. But but yes, absolutely, and I take great joy in it.
That's perfect. We can leave it at that. You know, I hear that once in a while. You know, but. Right. You know, it's all good. Do you think, you know, another thing is too, you know, when you said, you know, during lockdown and stuff, and when you're writing over a situation when things were in lockdown and that kind of stuff was going on, do you think that gets into your writing even if you're not conscious of it? Do you think you could look back at what you wrote over, let's say, COVID days?
Yes.
And there's going to be something that you notice that's different?
I tell you what, I cannot keep... at this point, I can't write any more books that this one does not have this, but any more books that have a plague in them. I can, for some reason, it factors into every plot, and I know that's where it's from. Like, it's somehow, you know, I've been trying to deal with that situation and that. But I had the one book, before this. It's a 17th century novel set in the 17th century, and it's called The Promise of Plague Wolves, and it's about smallpox, you know, in 17th century Austria. And I know that that's where that comes from, you know. And I'd written a short story for an anthology called The She-Wolf and Saint Edmund, and it's set during the Black Death in the Middle Ages, and I need to quit.
Yeah, enough is enough, you know. It's just funny because I always have the YouTube and I'm running old movies when I'm working. And one came on the other day and it was about, I think it was the TB that happens in New York and the outbreak and the plague and all this stuff. And then they had all these, they had protesters saying don't inject the poison. And it was just
right.
It was so today.
Yes. Well, I had read this book called Pox Americana, and it's a really interesting. It's a nonfiction book, and it's about smallpox epidemic during the American Revolution. So 1775, it breaks out, and they didn't have the smallpox vaccine back then, but they had inoculation, right, where they would intentionally infect you. Kind of rub like a scab, like they get pus from a scab and give you smallpox that way. And it would give you a milder case and you were likely to survive it. And yet, and this is the 1770s, people came out in protest of that, saying you're defying God's will, you know, by inoculating. And so it was fascinating to me. This book was written back in like 2005, I think, so it was not influenced by COVID. And yet the arguments against inoculation were very familiar when I read that.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why I was surprised that they actually, they had the same problems. They had the same complaints. It's just different people.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's the same rhetoric. I mean, if it's the same, the argument has the same shape to it. And it's just incredible to me that is that consistent.
What's interesting is I'm in a family of that type, which I'm not, but it's really millions of people. So I just tell them, I said, listen, millions of people, humans, are wrong, regardless of which side is correct.
Right.
That just doesn't do well for human beings.
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of sad at times. It is in a way. It's depressing that we can't seem to grasp something, you know, same as I'm watching these things from the 60s and then they have all the moon people on like, what's my line, you know, shows and stuff. And that's a great place to find dialogue.
Yes.
And then they have people that are astronauts and stuff. And I'm just thinking when they're sitting on the panel, I would just think, you know, do you know in 50, 60 years, they're going to say, you never walked the moon. It's all fake.
Yeah.
You know, what would they think? It's just crazy some of the things that we go through. And
I was thinking the other day, in a class, I was talking about, I was focusing on the 16th century. And I was trying to make the case that people in the 16th century believed that the world was a sphere. and that no one thought the world was flat unless you're a crackpot, and the, you know, even the 1500s. And I thought to myself, more people on YouTube today believe that the world is flat than believed it in the 1500s.
Yeah, I had Mark Sargent on the show. He's the leader out of Portland, Oregon, of the Flat Earth Society, and he has 300,000 people that have joined the Flat Earthers Society. 300,000.
No shortage of believers, yeah.
So, hey, you know, things are looking up.
this being human thing is going great. Yeah, we're doing really well.
It's moving right along. Yeah, anyway. Well, that's fantastic. We're glad you came on the show. Good little talk, and we'll have your website, your books, everything's going to be up on ours so people can find it easily. And what can I say? It's been a pleasure. And your newest book, of course, the last book and what we were talking about is A Seance for Wicket King Death. And Coy Hall is the author and guest. Thank you.
Well, thank you both very much.
Nice speaking with you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.